on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we speak with Canberra poet Kathy Kittaway, who has worked in various forms, particularly in tanka, short poems based on a Japanese form. Plus, the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news and events from around the region. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Kathy Kittaway began writing poetry in the early 1980s while living in Papua New Guinea. She settled in Canberra in 1984 and became prominent in publishing her own collections as well as in community writing projects and workshops and the editing of periodicals and anthologies. Among many awards for her publications, in 2009, she received Arts ACT funding to complete a residency in Lochinvar, Scotland, to collaborate with Scottish potter Fergus Stewart. Each book that you're doing or done is different.
Yes.
You know, one is a collaboration with a potter, one is tanka, but it's backed against the diary or the journal. And then you've got another one in the works.
Yes.
So could you just speak to that a little bit?
Well, the one in the works at the moment is new and selected. And the title of that is The Art of Catching Jam Before It Burns. And it's, of course, not just about making jam. It's about making sense of life in a natural way. And the other books, well, struggling into winter, I just decided to experiment with tanka, and I knew that in Japan it's quite natural for Japanese poets to write a diary, and for years I've kept journals and I've taught journals. But I just decided to experiment, and the first day that I decided to do that, my best friend was dying of cancer, and I only got the news that day. So it was an interesting it was a bit hard, but it was an interesting journey. So that really is about how I'm coping with my friend's cancer. And not just concentrating on it, though. Living life despite what you're dealing with. And that's the basis of that. And the title comes from the oaks that in Officer Crescent, they straggle into winter. And so I was straggling into winter, not wanting to really go there, but just, you know, staying as much as I can in spring and summer during that journey.
Kathy Kittaway next spoke about her collection, Deep in the Valley of Teebles, which appeared from Interactive Press in 2014. She prepared it after 2009 Arts ACT funding took her to Lochinvar, Scotland.
Deep in the Valley of Teebles, I wrote that with a dear potter friend. He was in Strathnan here for years, and I used to trot along to his studio with my notebook and pen, and he'd always have the fire going and we would talk, and I began to realise that he also loved the Japanese pottery. So we used to talk a lot about that, and he would potter and I would just write. I'm not necessarily looking to do poetry, just write about being there. And we got on so well that 10 years later, I think, we decided, well, why don't we do a book together? So that's how that came about. The other thing is I've worked with a lot of other poets, also with a dancer, Elizabeth Dalman. Mm-hmm. I worked with her company. We put on a whole concert, actually, at the front many years ago, and they just approached me if they could improvise to my poetry, and so the whole performance was no music. They just danced to my poetry and my voice many years ago. Yeah. Yes. Yes, Elizabeth and I worked together a lot, though. I used to just trot along to her studio and just sit there and write, and some of the poems that I did write, she would also put into the performance. I must declare that I'm a twin. I have a twin brother. He died 10 years ago. And I just began to realise that I like to work with others. The foundation being, I'm a twin. And yeah. So I love the feedback from others. Though I'm very good on my own. I can initiate all the time on my own, but I do like to work with others.
It does seem like a natural impulse to kind of team up.
Yeah.
With the other arts. But how do you think that specifically or particularly informs your poetry?
Oh, I wouldn't think of things. Once I'm having a conversation with somebody else or watching their art, I'm informed by their art, how it will transform into my poetry. And that's the glory of it, you know, that you and many writers I've written with, things will occur. Their response to my work has me thinking differently again, which wouldn't occur to me. So, yeah, there's two minds.
Kathy Kidawai has written collaborative books with, for example, poets Amelia Fielden and Beverly George, an unusual practice at the time.
I think it naturally allows for juxtaposition it's almost like you're putting together a puzzle and each poet or each artist brings a different piece.
Yes.
And the piece can stand by itself.
It has to stand by itself.
But when it's together with other pieces, there's a greater whole.
That's right, that's the difference between tanka, even tanka sequences, and free verse sequences. You're dealing with the layout of the poem with the free verse, and each stanza doesn't necessarily have to stand on its own. It relates to the one before and the one behind. With the tanka sequence, the same thing occurs, but each tanka has to be a poem on its own right. You could take it out of that sequence and it would stand on its own right. It's much more challenging and much more interesting to do that.
My co-host, Peter Searles, asked Kathy Kidawai what led her to work with tanka.
I don't know. It took me by surprise. I remember when I said I was going to write tanka, all my artist friends said, oh, God, about time. they recognised in me that Eastern understanding of literature, and I wasn't recognising it in myself. And what I like about Japanese writers, they want to give you the poem. They don't necessarily are not looking for praise for that at all. They want you to experience it. Instead of saying, oh, look at that line there, that's a good pose, or did you see that, did you miss that? That doesn't interest them at all. It's a way of writing that the poem belongs to the reader.
I saw a description of it in your book that the reader sort of completes the composition, which I thought was a really interesting idea. Yeah.
Well, I think poetry is a partnership. It's a partnership between you and the reader. I don't write to please the reader to begin with. I write because the poem is wanting to be written. It's when I start to edit, I then think, how can the reader receive this? And how can I move back from the poem as much as possible? So that it's the poem that's important. The poet and the poem are two different things.
And when you came to collaborate with Fergus Stewart, the potter, was the link in the Japanese cultural traditions between the tea ceremonies and the tanka style, was that part of what drew you to that collaboration, or was it something else?
It was I knew that he knew about this, and it was the way he used to talk about the clay. It was the way, the fineness of his work. He's a very fine potter. To me, he's a master potter. He may not have seen himself in that way. He was a potter who did tableware. He wasn't, again, not trying to impress. It's everyday things that you hold, and that's what attracted me to him, because to me, I write about the everyday life. That is what's important to me, the extraordinariness of being ordinary. So it's not ordinary. Every moment is extraordinary. And so he viewed pottery in the same way. So that was our link, really.
It seems like in the book you're often finding like parallels between the writing of the poetry and the art of making, of the pottery.
Yes.
So what were some of the parallels that you found?
Well, everything that he was doing, I was looking for equivalent, you know, which was, you know, even the bending and the stretching of the clay. It's, you know, the same thing that I'm twisting and turning to get the answers myself as a poet. The fact, I mean, the sequence I'd like to read to you is the kiln sequence there. That is extraordinary experience. And as you noticed in that book, in the middle there, I went to the prose to explain that, because it's extraordinary. Yeah. It's like Christmas every time that you go to a wood fired. The whole thing that you do before you even begin to, you know, the kiln, you've got to order the wood, you've got to chop the wood, you've got to stack the wood, you know, it takes ages, and then it's 24 hours or more before you move away from the kiln. So I'll read them twice. The Potter's Mind. He wads pots, sweeps and packs the kiln. Nothing prepares her for the sunset in glazes, radiating rusty red. He wads pot, sweeps and packs the kiln. Nothing prepares her for sunsets in glazes, radiating rusty red. Keeping track, he charts temperatures every hour. Oh, the inquisitiveness of salt in the heat. Keeping track, he charts temperatures every hour. Oh, the inquisitiveness of salt in the heat. She wanders, burns in boulders in each glaze, cradles teapots in each palm as she drinks. She wanders, burns and boulders in each glaze, cradles teapots in each palm as she drinks. How to attain natural ash glazing diligently with unwavering focus? He strokes and stokes the kiln. How to attain natural ash glazing diligently with unwavering focus? He strokes and stokes the kiln. Sheer pottery, leaping from the kiln. Will her poem make marks that keep on burning? Sheer poetry, leaping from the kiln. Will her poem make marks that keep on burning? Flashing in the darkness, potter, wood, firebox, pen on the page. Flashing in the darkness, potter, wood, firebox, pen on the page. Can Christmas gifts wrapped under tree compare with a kiln cool enough to open brick by brick? Can Christmas gifts wrapped under the tree compare with a kiln cool enough to open brick by brick? Pots fired and ready in the kiln, shouting, "Look at me, look at me." Were her children any different? Pots fired, ready in the kiln, shouting, "Look at me, look at me." Were her children any different? Open mouth, the kiln not always speaking of perfect pots. He lifts this one, that, searching for words. Open mouth, the kiln, not always speaking of perfect pots. He lifts that one, searching for words. The potter, a mentor she seeks, the cup handle distorted in his kiln, his. The potter, a mentor she seeks, the cup handle distorted in the kiln, his. Even the best of friends disagree. He listens later, as best he can, to pots with little to say. Even the best of friends disagree. He'll listen later, as best he can, to pots with little to say. They linger in the corner of the kiln, tea bowls glazed in deeper hues, smoke the colour of sorrow. They linger in the corner of the kiln, tea bowls glazed in deeper hues, smoke the colour of sorrow. What's to be gained by studying Zen? He reads this perfect glaze, that lopsided bowl. What's to be gained by studying Zen? He reads this perfect glaze, that lopsided bowl. Does it get harder or easier each firing to trash distorted pots and finally cracked dreams? Does it get harder or easier each firing to trash distorted pots and finally cracked dreams? Is there anything quite as accidental or curious as the magic of salt? Aha, the potter's mind. Is there anything quite as accidental or curious as the magic of salt? Aha, the potter's mind.
I'm thinking so much about what you're saying about the reader meeting the poem and how that is, I think, more of a Eastern tradition to make a space and invite the reader in to the space and then just see what happens.
Yeah.
So I notice in your poems a tendency towards the ineffable. And what your poems do is make a space for what can't be said.
Yes.
And then somehow the saying can happen in the unsaid.
Exactly.
I don't know if that makes sense.
It's absolutely. You put it in better words than I can explain. Mm. The Japanese poets do exactly the same thing. Mm. They are they are endeavoring to say the unsaid.
Right.
It's called the dreaming room. And it's not the dreaming room in the original sense, but they call that the dreaming room. And a tanka is good when there's a dreaming room there, when the tanka, when the reader goes, aha.
Yes.
It's called the aha moment. Yeah. But I do the same thing with free verse.
You do. Mm. I also see it happening in Mary Oliver's poems.
Absolutely.
And I know you're a fan of Mary Oliver.
And I know that it's one of the things that draws me to her, is the space she leaves for the reader.
I suggested to Kathy that her writing in Straggling into Winter resonated with a poem by Mary Oliver, The Black Snake. Here's that poem. The Black Snake. When the black snake flashed onto the morning road and the truck could not swerve. Death, that is how it happens. Now he lies looped and useless as an old bicycle tire. I stop the car and carry him into the bushes. He is as cool and gleaming as a braided whip. He is as beautiful and quiet as a dead brother. I leave him under the leaves and drive on, thinking about death, its suddenness, its terrible weight, its certain coming. Yet under reason burns a brighter fire, which the bones have always preferred. It is the story of endless good fortune. It says to oblivion, not me. It is the light at the center of every cell. It is what sent the snake coiling and flowing forward, happily, all spring, through the green leaves, before he came to the road.
She writes about life and death a lot. Mm. She has such great respect for animals, life, insects. That's another thing that draws me to her. I've been teaching Mary Oliver probably for about 20 years here in Australia, in Canberra. And I know when I mention Mary Oliver, people go, oh, yeah, Mary Oliver. But they've moved on. They think they've moved on from her. Mm. Mary Oliver, to me, is a poet who is before her time, even now. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. We seem to categorise poets, and she's categorised as an environmentalist and dismissed. Well, even in that, she's before her time. It's the questions that she leaves the writer with too, and that's what I like. That, to me, is a good poet who can leave you with pondering the question.
When you're able to use words to access absence and talk about what isn't there as much as what is there, how does that even begin? Right, I'm thinking about this, and then I read this poem of yours. Which comes first? Those silhouettes, eucalypts, my poetry, or the musing? And I thought, she's got a poem that asks this question about her own poetry.
Yeah, yeah. I've often taught this to my students also when they're making statements. Okay, how would that be if you asked that as a question? Mm. Let the reader answer it. It's a way of bringing the reader into it too. But
when you're teaching Mary Oliver, in what form is it? Do you have a group or you have...
Okay, over the years I've just brought her in as a poem to take notice of. I think it was the 18th of May in 2021. I set out to do a 6-week course in what is known as Kate's Kitchen. I like to bring poets into my kitchen because they've got the coffee going. They're going to have the afternoon tea. They're going to actually relax more than, you know. This started when I started bringing students home from a course I might have done and they wanted to come home. So I'd say, come home to Kate's Kitchen, which is my kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Very humble kitchen, so they can relax. So I invited these people into a 6-week course, and then they just wouldn't go home.
Oh.
And so last Tuesday, I brought it to an end.
Did you?
I did. In the end, I said, okay, All right, you've all got it became a masterclass in the end. So I just thought, look, let's have a 6 weeks break and we meet every 6 weeks just to catch up so that you utilize what you're learning and doing and so forth. But so how do I teach it? One thing leads to another. I don't know how to explain that. I asked one of the poets to volunteer to bring the poem along that we're just going to start the session with, and we'll just read it. And I'm a great believer that we all relearn in different ways, by our ears, our sight, and what we say.
Sure.
So the person who brings the poem reads the poem, and then she has copies for everybody else, and then we read one stanza on each or one line each around the poem so that you can now pick it up for yourself. So I've also taught them to look at a poem for 5 days, like sit with a poem and not just listen to a poem. Sit with it, write it by hand in your journal or whatever, and every day go to that poem and find something new in it every day for 5 days. It's amazing what you discover. You're scrambling by the fifth, but then you go, oh, and then you see something really amazing. It's been the reading of poets that's taught me. Two of my favourite poets, Judith Beveridge, David Brooks. David Brooks is not talked about enough. They're both Australian poets. David Brooks is an amazing poet. He also speaks a lot about non-human animals in a way that Judith does too, in as much as they do something that Billy Collins has taught me, which is, he says, when you're writing, there are two subjects that come up, the one you start writing about and the one that occurs to you as you're writing. And David Brooks and Judith Beveridge and Mary Oliver do that.
They do.
Yeah.
Right. In a way, I don't know, people sometimes roll their eyes when I use this word, but you know, there is the epiphany, right?
And, yes.
And it, in a way, that's it. It's an epiphany cannot be planned for.
No.
It can only be encountered or
as you
even
do it.
Happened upon. Yeah.
Yeah.
I asked Kathy Kittaway to read some of her poems, some of the ones with non-human animals. She sang of a cockroach.
Well, this one is just about an insect, actually. A quick word or two. Moved by the vast museum of insignificant things by Gaston Bichelard. Near the altar on the landing, near the pillar where they worship, dying on the stairs lay a cockroach. The janitor should have swept from view of Miss McCoy leaning on her walking stick and Father Brian breaking bread before reading sacred texts for the day. Ignored by the cat, feet no longer railing against the lack of air, its carapace buffed with candlelight, the cockroach was a night fit for a funeral. James put it in a matchbox, buried it outside the church before glancing Godward to ask his creator if he could hear a quick word or two for a warrior who had expired full armour in the dust. Above the sound of hymns sung by Miss McCoy and Father Brown for all creatures great and small, near the altar on the landing, near the pillar where they worship.
To celebrate a cockroach through language, through image, is it does remind me of Mary Oliver. It's that idea of taking what we usually go past, right? Usually we walk past the dead
insect. Insignificant things.
That's right.
Yes.
Even maybe let ourselves be disturbed by it.
That's right.
But in this case, to really carefully find the value of life through its very tiny existence.
Yeah.
It's really what the poem does.
I think I've always lived in that world.
Mm.
That poetry has given me the vehicle with which to express it.
How about another poem?
Another poem?
Yeah.
I also write about sad things in life. This one's an older one too, called White is for Mourning in China. I have never travelled in a rickshaw, ploughed with an ox or planted rice, my bare feet drenched with mud, long sweat-stained hair swept back under a bamboo hat. I have my own culture, my own childhood garden of Eden. I have never thought that death would come in any colour other than the shallow shade of sibling skin, puffed under red-rimmed eyes the night my twin brother died. My black dress, a shroud at the back of the wardrobe, hangs like a bat, clinging to darkness no one can let out. Shall I give it to St. Vinny's or the woman next door who moved in last year? She grows bok choy in her backyard and stir-fries the air with aromas of ginger, chicken and spice. Her mother died on the way to Australia. We have our own way of grieving, but we talked about her mother and my twin brother over fortune cookies and tea for the first time last week. I have never laughed so much with a neighbour the way I have since she moved in. They wear white for mourning in China. My black dress might be enticing, enfolded in tissue paper, tied with a ribbon, and we could share oohs and ahs as it flutters free from its wrappings. The death of my twin brother 10 years ago was the most hardest one for me to deal with, and so I guess that's what the impetus of that poem and why I wrote that poem. Mm. It was the hardest one because it's hard to explain to people, if you're not a twin, what it's like.
Yeah.
As a small child, I remember I would have been barely able to talk, but watching people walk around without the other side of themselves.
Yes.
And it was strange for me. How could they stand up, or how can they be without the other part of yourself?
Right. What was your brother's name?
John.
John.
Yes. Mm. If he walked into a room, I felt tremendous. It's an unexplainable thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was happy. I was safe. I don't know. I was there fully. And I was with somebody who knew me.
Yes.
Without being told.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, we've welcomed Canberra poet Kathy Kittaway. As we heard, she has often collaborated with other poets and artists. Next week, we'll return to the subject of collaboration with two keen poet analysts, Paul Hetherington and Cassandra Atherton. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. The Poetic City Winter Edition on Monday, July 10, will hold two events. From 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m, the Poetry is Innovation Machine Symposium will take place at the Cultural Centre Cambry on the ANU campus. Speakers from various academic and artistic fields will present ideas about poetry at the symposium, a collaboration of the festival, the University of Canberra Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, and Uncharted Territory Winter Innovation Festival. At 7 p.m, the festival will hold a closing night at Smith's Alternative in Civic. Festival events continue even after the closing night. On Wednesday, July 12, round 2 of the Fridge Magnet Poetry Olympics takes place from 1 to 2 p.m. on the Northbourne Avenue median between the Sydney and Melbourne buildings. On Thursday, July 13, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m, a free drop-in program for primary school-aged children is scheduled at the Canberra Museum and Gallery, Your Place, Your Lens, poetry and art inspired by the museum's Capturing Canberra exhibition. On Friday, July 14, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m, again at the Canberra Museum and Gallery, Mr. Tim and Miss Nath will present a workshop for children 7 to 13, Songs Are Poems. Look online for Poetic City Canberra Winter Edition. The submission deadline for entries to the University of Canberra Vice-Chancellor's International Poetry Prize has been extended to 17 July. The University's Centre for Creative and Cultural Research has announced that the judges this year will be Tony Barnstone from the United States and Mani Rao from India. Search online for University of Canberra Vice-Chancellor's International Poetry Prize 2023. That deadline again is July 17. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of Art Sound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produce the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music for today's program has been from Lucas Nilly's 2022 recording, Still Storm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atria Musica de Madrid.